but it goes on a little while. We have our Q&A session. It's live streamed. Is it being live streamed now? Excellent. So for those of you who are joining in from overseas, because there are many places in our world which do not have Buddhist centres, and we use the internet to live stream major events such as these, and people actually they join in from lots and lots of different places throughout the world, including places like Syria and Aden, and places where it's almost impossible to have a Buddhist centre. So it's wonderful for those of you tuning in from overseas just to see we've just had a magnificent gift of books, Buddhist arts, which detail some of the inspirational artworks which are either carved or painted, calligraphy, many, many different parts of the Buddhist world to show just how inspiring this Buddhist tradition can be. So anyway, that I'm not quite sure. You probably have your jobs to do this afternoon and other things. You're probably working very hard. But just to let people know from overseas that thank you so much for coming here and joining in together. We may be different races, types of Buddhism, but we always, my little simile was the different types of Buddhism is you may have like Tibetan Buddhism or Mahayana Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism. It's all the same cake with different icing. So strawberry icing is Tibetan Buddhism. You see their robes, they're sort of dark red, maroon. Vanilla icing, that's usually the Zen monks because they are just all Zen. This is Theravada, we love chocolate. So that's dark chocolate, this is milk chocolate. Icing. And you're somewhere in between. Very good. Okay, so photo time. So please, yes, you're most welcome to do the photo op, and then just for those overseas, we just a few moments where we do the photo op, and then. Yeah. No, no, it's okay. We're just really easy going. Nothing is certain, so. Oh, really? Okay. Okay. Okay, welcome. See you again next time. Very good. Happy WASAC Day. Excellent. Two more nuns. So your nuns?
Yeah, the afternoon session.
Okay. Oh, they'll be here soon. Yeah. It's one of the wonderful things sometimes about our traditional Buddhism. Sometimes we're never on time, which means we don't have stress. We relax. Sometimes it causes stress for other people. We're not here on time. But anyway, so we are now going to have a session. Here, we always tend to have the monks and the nuns actually preaching, giving talks. And it's number one, it's very rare to have the monks and the nuns together on the same platform and to be able to have, like, questions. I know that I was looking at the news sites. They have like board meetings when you look at the board members and the shareholders ask some difficult questions. But now it's not so much difficult questions about the management, about the Dharma. It's an opportunity now for you to actually to ask some questions about Buddhism or even just Buddhist art and the publication of it. You know, are you inspired by Buddhist art? And of course, I was telling one young person the other day that when I did manage to go to Borobudur, and just outside of Borobudur there was another temple called Vihara Mendut. And there it's just also very ancient. And there you can see the carving, one of the nicest carvings I ever saw was the carving of the talkative tortoise. And that's, you know, in the book of Open the Door of Your Heart. And if you don't know the story, I'm not going to do it now, because it takes a bit of a while. But it's an ancient story, and it's carved there on the rocks. Maybe, was it 500-600 years old? We have a Mendut. And there you can actually see the two swans with a stick and a tortoise holding on into the middle, the flying tortoise. It's wonderful to see some of these stories which you say have got a long history. So Buddhist art is not always formal. Sometimes it tells interesting stories, and some of those old Jataka stories can be very humorous but also very helpful for us. So anyway, who is going to ask the first question for this afternoon? So see where we can go with the questions. Yes, thank you.
Can you explain the Dhamma? What's the meaning of Dhamma? The truth of Dhamma.
The Dhamma. Now that is a very deep question. Sometimes a good explanation of that, this is technical, I hope you don't mind. They have two words, like Dhamma, and they have its opposite. It's called Atta, A-T-T-H-A in the Roman Pali. Now, you may have heard that, you know, the Dhamma, and you also may have heard that from the Atta-Gatha, the commentaries. And it's also in the Pali. If they say, offered me some water, they say, you know, is this of Atta for you? Is it of use and benefit for you? And the lovely meaning of that, I have to acknowledge Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi in one of his books, where he made this wonderful simile. We have the experience right now, and the Dhamma is where it's coming from, its source, its law, like the laws of science, the why, the cause. That's called the Dhamma. It's looking at phenomena and finding out, where do they come from? Why does this happen? Looking back to its origin. And the Atta is taking this particular experience of now. Where does it lead to? What's its consequence? Now, what happens afterwards? So those two words, the Dhamma, is like the why, and the Atta is, what's the consequence of this? What happens afterwards? Where does this lead to? So those two words, for me, that made a huge difference in understanding what these things are. We look at phenomena and just, why does this happen? Where's it coming from? What's like the rules, the laws of nature, the causes, the science of the mind, the why? And that's where the Dhamma is, the cause, the origin, the source. The understanding why things happen, like the laws of science. The Atta is the consequences, what happens afterwards. So you have the Dhamma, you know, what the Buddha taught, you know, explained, you know, the causes of things. And once we know just the rules, the way that the world works, then we can actually understand where this is going to lead to. So, you know, you become a monk or a nun, where does that lead to? What's the purpose of this? The purpose, you know, the outcome, that's the Atta. The why, where is this all coming from? That's the Dhamma. Make any sense? No? Okay.
It understood it, Dhamma is anatta.
Oh, that is some of the explanations, the characteristics of the Dhamma. So if you go to the source of things, you go to the origin, the why, the basic laws of life. You know, obviously one of those is the anicca, dukkha, anatta. And, you know, those laws of anicca, again, it's not just impermanence. It's like uncertainty, irregular, sometimes that what you really thought was always there sometimes vanishes. It shocks you sometimes when you go deeper into the nature of things. And of course, dukkha is just, this is one thing which many people resist, but It is like we are born in a prison. We've lived all our life in a prison. And we don't realize it's a prison. We spend most of our life just making our prison the most comfortable place we can possibly be in, decorating it. Sometimes we find another nice little prisoner and marry him and have and have nice little babies in the prison. And we go to school in the prison. And we have to work in the prison. And if we work very well, we can get a very nice little big cell in our prison. And much bigger than other people's cells. And we can get a nice little vehicle to go from one part of the prison to another. And you know, even we can even travel in the aircraft from one part of the prison to the other. But it's always a prison. But because we don't know any different, we think that even this prison, no, it's not bad. But after a while we realize that all of this is a prison. And there is an outside. So we understand just much of what is dukkha, suffering, we take to be happiness. This is one of the sayings of Venerable Sariputta, the wisest monk next to the Buddha, who said that what unenlightened people say is suffering, enlightened ones say is happiness. What unenlightened beings say is happiness, the enlightened ones say is suffering. So that's suffering. And anatta is, there's no one here anyway. So, anatta is just emptiness, nothing here. So, the old simile of the driverless bus. Just, there's no one driving the bus, so what are you complaining about?
Cause and effect.
Yeah. So anyway, for those of you that goes too deep, there was, you know, humanistic Buddhism is actually making Buddhism more about ordinary people, so we can all understand it. So there's one of these ex-monks who said there were these three people went into the bar, because into the pub, you know, jokes is three people. Anicca, dukkha, anatta went into the pub. And dukkha said, this pub is terrible. It's awful, this pub. That's dukkha. And anicca said, oh, don't worry, it will pass. And anatta said, who said that? Who said that? That's anicca, dukkha, anatta. And that description of anicca, dukkha, anatta passes what we call in Australia the pub test. I understand that. Would you like to add anything to that? No? Okay. That's always a difficulty to get these terms and to give them some explanation which everybody, a lot of people, can understand. But sometimes, you know, some of the explanations do challenge you. And they're supposed to challenge you. Because without that challenge, you know, there's no real growth. You know, you go to the gym or you do your walking, you sit. Sometimes you come across the old brick wall and you just find a way to go further, to go deeper, to go beyond. And that sometimes is going past your comfort zone. Which is one of the reasons why that the path is... it's not dull, but it's full of really interesting experiences. As a monk, as a teacher, as a nun, building monasteries and doing things you never expected you'll ever do in your life. Isn't that the case, Venerable? So what unexpected things have you been doing which you haven't told me about yet?
Yeah, to become a nun.
Oh, I ordained you, I was there anyway.
Yeah.
So did you ever expect to be a senior nun looking after all these other young
nuns,
old nuns as well? Go to
No. I was thinking that once I become a nun, okay, I'm out of it.
Out of it.
Okay.
And now you're further in it.
Yeah.
So... how long have you been a bhikkhuni now?
Bhikkhuni 9 years.
Nine.
And then seminary 4 years, and Anagarika 2 years.
Okay, so of all those years, what have you learnt?
Huh? Oh, all these years. Oh, I learnt to, I have to be forced to let go.
Forced to let go, yes.
And sometimes I have to close my eyes as if I don't see. I feel better. You know, sometimes, you know, you take it easy, not to take things too seriously. It's true, if you take it too seriously, you suffer so much. So if you don't take it seriously, and you know, you suffer less. You lessen your suffering.
Yeah.
So not to take it too seriously.
Yeah, because you don't take, you do, it's true, you suffer less, but you make other people suffer. Because you don't do your job.
No, of course I do my job. Of course I do my job, but you know, sometimes I find that it's very good that you, the trust is actually is important. Like, yes, I trust all the nuns. I trust them really. I just whatever, I you know,
but
even
they don't
turn up for the seat, you know.
But you didn't say about the monks. You don't trust the monks.
I trust you, Abhijan. Actually, when you trust them, you give them the confidence, you know. And they feel good about themselves. They've been trusted. And you give them the confidence, the faith in themselves. And sometimes it's really no good. Like even sometimes the nuns invite admonitions that, you know, please point out if I have done anything, any mistake, and just let me know. I said, imagine if at every single thing, someone around, you know, keep telling you that this is not right, that is not right, this is not right, you know. Actually, it's very damaging, you know. You just feel like, my goodness, after that you feel so anxious and a lot of fear. You just so fear that you're going to do something wrong. If someone keep telling you that you're wrong, you're not doing the right thing. Actually, once becomes a monk or nuns, that you know, they're still the same old person, you know. It's not going to change overnight. They say it's important to give people space, you know, time. It takes time to change, you know. So they were not going to change overnight. Doesn't mean that, you know, they put on the robes and then the next day, that you know, that all the defilements gone and like that. No! So yeah, just trust them and, you know, give them, you know, give them the confidence, you know, to trust them and give them the time and give them space to grow. They need to have space to grow.
Sada, sada, sada. Because I've been here the longest and look how much I've grown. Okay, let's have some questions from the audience. Yes, we have over there. And you can ask which one you want to ask the question of. It doesn't have to be the senior monks. Senior nuns can be the ones sitting in the... To my
and then this is for you.
Oh, dear. Okay.
I just wanted to know, if somebody has done hundreds of hours of meditation and yet the mind goes to the past. Is something wrong with the meditation or is it natural that it happens?
Well, straight away, hundreds of hours? Have you been counting? That means you've been living in the past. So it's natural.
Because I have been meditating for many years, so if
let that all go. What happens in the past? So, just meditate in this moment. And all those years you've been meditating, just don't hang on to those. All that just disappears. And that means, this is an important point, that sometimes people have been having, say on a retreat, very difficult time meditating and they're not getting anywhere. And sometimes you just say, just forget about that. Just, this is the first day of the retreat, right now. And it's the ninth day. Imagine this is the very first day. You just come here, fresh mind. Just not let all the other stuff go. Because it's the memory of the past. It stops you. It's a burden. And it stops you having a very wonderful meditation right now. So it doesn't matter how many hours you've meditated. It's just how much you can let go. And just this moment, only moment, just give everything to this moment. Let all the fears of the future, all the failures of the past, that's just disappear. That's the way to go. But you have like the example of, you know, the Buddha and his enlightenment. Just doing so much hours of meditation. Now for 6 years, all sorts of hard stuff. He had to all, let that all go when he sat under the Bodhi tree. Start afresh. Let the past go. To be free. So it doesn't matter how many hours. You know, there's this young boy here the other day just mentioning there was these 7-year-olds in the time of the Buddha. They just became enlightened almost immediately. Very clear minds, fresh. And they were asking just, well, how old do you have to be to become, to ordain, being a monk or nun? And they say in the scriptures, you have to be old enough to scare crows. And if that was the case, there's a crow which lives outside my room over here, and I've never been able to scare it away. So if that was real standard, I would never be allowed to ordain. But all it really meant was just to be alive, old enough, big enough to, you know, to look after yourself. But it's wonderful to be able to let go of the past. Don't define yourself by the past. To disappear, vanish. We define ourselves. Who are you? Are you from New Zealand? No, you're not. That's where you were born. But so when we identify with those sorts of things, we build a sense of self and identity. That is so hard to let that go. So it's nice to be a no one. Really hard to do, but it's nice to be no one, so you can just disappear. That is why, you know, with the Buddhist iconography, that in the earliest days of Buddhism, that's why they said the 4th century, I think they said, I was listening to the presentation, the earliest pieces of Buddhist art, or at least the pictures of Buddha statues, because early on in Buddhism there was no statue of the Buddha. Whenever you see any of the carvings, it was always an empty seat, a Bodhi tree with nothing underneath, the footprint, or the wheel of Dhamma, but never a person. And so even the Buddha themselves in the early days, they never had any pictures or statues of them. Because we're supposed to disappear and vanish. Is anatta, yeah, non-self, yeah. That's one of the reasons. Well, I know that we don't really do that in some places in Burma, Sri Lanka. You know, we put fans up in front of our face when we're teaching a sermon. And one of the reasons for that is actually so it takes away the personality. You can't see the face of the person giving the talk. And of course it also helps, as you know, when we do Pirita chanting, because you can actually write it down so people can, so don't make so many mistakes.
We should have that. Exactly. If none of us have a fan,
you just... That's right. So you can't see what we're doing. That's right, yeah. No, so yeah. It's just, but it's also that if you try that, I can't see you either. So what it means is you're giving a talk, and then when you take the fan away, everyone's gone. Because it was a boring talk. So it's, you've got to get some feedback, contact with people. So anyway, that was the beginning parts. It was not a person. And that's why even just, I know, in Sri Lankan tradition, you don't have photos of monks on the shrine. And I kind of like that, but it's sometimes so hard to stop that. You say, well, it's, you know, it's just, it's respect. But even Buddha statues, it's sort of, you know, sometimes there's the Sri Lankan style, the Tibetan style, the Thai style, and sometimes, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have like an empty shrine? Yeah, so what happens though, you have that, we tried that, even Ajahn Chakra, we tried that at Bodhinyana Monastery, and have an empty shrine, and then we just go and people come and visit, and they put this on there and that on there, and just it fills up. So well, it needs something, there's nothing there. It's so hard to have emptiness and have an empty corner of a room and put nothing there. Yeah, because they didn't have to. Yeah. I remember in some of those temples we had to spend, the monks spent so much time cleaning the Buddha statues. And sweeping the big halls. So it's nice to have a few things. Yeah. 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 Yeah, representing you. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you've got to respect it. There was a person here in Perth, and they called me up because they were very scared. They had a Buddha statue from here, and they put it in their house, and the Buddha statue moved. And they said, first of all, they said, it must have been the husband or the kids or something. And so they asked them and said, no, we didn't touch it. And so I told them, just make sure, tell all the people in the house, don't touch that Buddha statue, see what happens tonight. Because he straightened it, and the next night it moved again. All by itself. No one touched it at all. No, it wasn't a dog or a cat. It was up high. Now, you know what was going on with it? We checked it out. No, it wasn't the wind. No, it was something weird because it was actually facing a mirror on the hall itself. And some there's racing, so it didn't like that. So put it in a different place. I took the mirror away, and then it never moved at all. And I mention that because if you ever go to Bodhinyana Monastery, you see the big Buddha statue we have there is facing west. And as soon as we put it there, it was actually not my fault, it was Ajahn Jaco, he was a boss then, but we put it facing west, and as you know, it's tradition for the Buddha statues to face east. And so, when we had a senior monk come from Thailand, many members of our Thai community, they brought that up with him and said, these Western monks, they don't know what they're doing. The Buddha statue is facing the wrong direction. What should we do? And you know what the Thai monk said? He said, if the Buddha didn't like it, he would move around by himself. And it was a case of that. So this one over here has been this way for a long time now. So this Buddha is very happy. Faces the sunset. Very good. It's interesting. But you know, sometimes weird things do happen. It's only say that because there was in the suttas, the Manyapala Sutta, that's number 2 of the Digha Nikaya, there it was, King Ajatasattu went to visit the Buddha for the first time. And he was in the bamboo grove, Weluwana, outside of Rajagaha. When he went inside, first part of this, this king never seen the Buddha before and just asked, which one of those monks is the Buddha? Now the Buddha never stood out. Never sort of, you can't just see the whole group of monks, which one is the Buddha, which one is one of the other monks. And so the Jivaka, you know, who knew the Buddha, was the doctor of the Buddha, he said, the one in that pillar facing east, that is the Buddha. And because he was saying that he was facing east, that has been the tradition ever since, to face east. But that was only one time the Buddha was facing east. I'm sure that when he went to many other places, he didn't always take the compass with him to find out which is the east. Whichever was the most convenient place to face, that's the way you would face. This is where those traditions come from. Didn't have hair either. Yeah, no, that's another thing. Yeah. It's, you know, with all respect, that looks like afro. Curly hair. But, again, that was the tradition that when had the hair cut, so it all curled up in little things. But it was many times the people, one of those other stories, you remember that there was this monk who was coming from the west part of India. The monk who ordained him, I think it was Mahakachana or Kotita, one of those two. And this young monk was coming to see the Buddha. He never seen the Buddha before. And so in those days, you know, had to journey, you know, on foot from the west coast of India to the Ganges Valley. It took him many, many days. And on the journey, that he to stay overnight, there was the potter's workshop, which was just like a lean-to, and would be able to spend the night there. And so I asked the potter, okay, if I spend the night here, yeah, no trouble. And then a little while later, another monk came and also asked, can I stay the night here? And was one monk staying? If he doesn't mind, you can stay. So the other monk said, okay, you can stay here. So these two monks were stayed overnight. And in the evening, they meditated. And this young monk from the west saw this older monk. He was meditating, wonderful posture, very peaceful. So he thought, I'd better meditate too. And so the two of them, they meditated all night together. They never lay down and go to sleep. And in the morning, just before they went on arms round, the older monk said, oh, you meditate very well. Who's your teacher? He said, oh, my teacher is one of the disciples of the Buddha, and I'm travelling over to try and meet the Buddha. I've never seen him before, to pay worship. He said, oh, you're a very good monk. And then the young monk asked the older monk, who's your teacher? And the older monk said, I don't have a teacher. I'm the Buddha. Ah, I've been spending all night with the Buddha and I never realised it. I'm sorry. So that was one of those stories which actually tells you that, you know, in the time of the Buddha would, you know, appearance would be no different. You couldn't tell. At least that monk couldn't tell. But anyway, and very humble too. Didn't go around with a lot of attendants and disciples following him everywhere. Not a sort of a special robe, you know, just satin or lame or anything, just the ordinary robe like other monks. So it was almost indistinguishable. So, but then, as far as art is concerned, why do we have this big flame coming out of the Buddha's head, or sometimes a little bump like a top note, and this looks like hair? Because when we started to try and get these statues, we tried to, can we have it just like, looking like what the Buddha would have looked like in the time of the Buddha, you know, just bald and just maybe no bumps or no sort of flames coming out. But then it was the sculptures, the artist told me, he said, well, we can't do that because then we would never know what was a representation of the Buddha and what wasn't. This was actually almost like a way of designation, because there are other statues found which just have an ordinary bald head, and that was meaning another person, usually Mahavira, the leader of the Jains. And so this was like not meant to be look like a historical Buddha. It's not like a portrait, but a symbol. So it's a symbolism of it. So that's why, because it's symbolic, that's why you can have the flame of wisdom coming out, or you can have just little curly hairs coming out, just to distinguish it, to make sure that is a special statue of the Buddha. That's where it came from. Yes. Okay, come on. Faster, 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 faster. Yes, exercise.
Thank you. Do you think feelings of responsibility lead to attachment, and is that a negative thing?
Okay. Which nun would you like to ask?
Third from the right.
They're from Jessica. You've been spotted.
Okay.
Okay. Yes. She's a very responsible nun.
Areas of responsibility.
An attachment.
To attachment. Well, I guess if you are responsible for what you ask to do, you have to carry it out as best as you can, and depends on the result whether it pleases the person who asks you to do or not is something, you know, you can't really control. So if you're attached to what you want to hear, then that will not bring you much happiness. If you don't get to hear what you want to hear, then maybe it's a bit of a suffering or stress there. So I guess in terms of attachment, in my opinion, if you know you've done your best in the areas that you're responsible, and that's it, whatever comes back, praise or blame, or, you know, then, you know, you can't really control in that sense. But of course, it's easier said than done because we like to hear what we want to hear. So, yeah, it's just a matter of looking at the feeling, how you feel about whether are you very upset or a little upset or not affected by what people say after. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Connecting to that question and answering about attachment, I have a question for Acharya Brahma. That, as Bhikkhuni previously say, mentioned that being simple, take it easy like that. But in some of the, I see in the Buddhist meditations, is that having the objectives in your minds, it's connects your thoughts as a circle, and you following those objectives, and you creating a lot of objectives, and you following, and it's never ending. But in some of the professions, like I belong in the medicine, we need to have objects sometimes, and we sometimes have consequences if we not take it as a serious. But sometimes in the Buddhist meditation say that good, bad, who knows, like as Achan say that, sometimes we has to be, it has to be go correctly when we doing something. If sometimes not correct, sometimes we have a feeling of that failure or like that. So if you can comment on that, how to overcome such kind of objectives when we work in different, very stressful professions. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, especially in medicine, that ultimately it's more important to care than to cure. So that sometimes people will feel you're being irresponsible there. You're not going through the normal ways of treating somebody. But then, you know, if you're caring much more than curing, you'll find that the cure rate goes up. You know, it's taking medicine and taking it further than where it was before. And this is one of the problems with you are stressed out because sometimes you're so narrow what you can do, what you can't do, and so afraid of just, you know, doing things which, you know, maybe not really what's standard knowledge. But sometimes, you know, that taking it further means you are taking medicine to a much deeper and better level. That's the old story of the professor at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. It must be about 30 years ago, who gave the opening lecture to the new intake of medical students and said, 50% of what we're going to teach you in the next 4 years is wrong. So my problem is I don't know which 50% that is. And to me, that always was a scientist. In other words, to, you know, if you can have the opportunity to, you know, to follow some of the things which are in your heart, to be intuitive as a doctor. And, you know, sometimes being responsible for many people means to being afraid. Being afraid what other people will say about you. Being afraid of failure. Being afraid of negative consequences. And I think many people will die because of that. Will get injured. Afraid. You follow the procedure. You do what other doctors would do. But then it doesn't work. Rather than sometimes doing what you feel intuitively, you know this is what should be done. And that is courageous. But I think it's really important. The caring and using your wisdom. The objectives are the same. It's the objectives are to lessen human suffering, to heal, to take people not just physically well-being, but their emotional and mental well-being as well. And those two are really, really important. Sometimes too much emotional, too much focused on the physical well-being and not so much the emotional well-being. Everyone gets hurt, including the doctors and the carers. I don't know if that makes sense, but maybe it does.
Ajahn, in your meditation book, it seems that you suggest that doing that present moment awareness for the early stage. Sometimes it's quite hard. Like I think our mind tend to be like grab things from one things to other things, even though not last long. Does the present moment awareness we have to get rid of that kind of moving from talk to thought, or just let it be? If you can, please.
Well, in the sense that it's the same question as before, this is where we aim to be peaceful, to be free in the present moment, happy. But how we get there? So how we get to that place, if you let things go, let things be kind, be patient, then that's where you eventually come to the present moment. Because if you try and force it, after a while, you just feel so tired, you feel so stressed out, the present moment's not a nice place. But if you just come to the present moment in a gentle, kind way, patient way, after a while the present moment comes and it's a nice place to hang out. So little by little what happens is that we have those stages of meditation, but don't look upon them as goals. It gives you some idea of where the meditation is. But if you try to get to those places, you'll never reach them. Just as I was saying to the nuns of Fokanshan, the simile of the donkey and the carrot, which you've heard me say before. The donkey got a stick on its neck, 2 foot in front of the donkey's head, the end of the stick. On the end of the stick, a string, on the end of the string, a carrot. Donkey sees the carrot there, I want carrot, so it starts walking towards the carrot, the stick moves, the string moves, and the carrot moves. Doesn't matter how fast that donkey runs after the carrot, never catches it. So that's when we have goals, things we want to achieve. Sometimes we can never reach there. And in meditation, that's so true, that people keep trying, they can sort of understand what present moment awareness is, what breath, nimitta, jhanas, enlightenment. You can explain all of those things, but you just can't get there. So what happens is the simile of the donkey and the carrot. As many of you know, you run as fast as you can after the carrot. I don't need to teach you to do that because you've been doing that most of your life. But then you learn how to stop. And as soon as you stop, things go wrong. The carrot moves further away. But you're patient. Because when the carrot's about 4 foot away from your mouth, then something strange happens. It starts swinging towards you. And soon it's 2 foot in front of your mouth, swinging at top speed. And then you don't do anything, you just wait. And soon it just comes right to your mouth. And the only thing to remember is like compassion, kindness, which is so important in all stages of the path. Just before the carrot hits your teeth and bounces back, you remember, carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. So the carrot can come in. Sounds a bit strange, but if you understand that, a lot of times in meditation, we try so hard, we get frustrated. So when we learn how to let go, to relax, be patient in this moment, you'll find that, at first maybe you go to sleep, first you may get a bit restless. Just hang in there, don't do anything. And then you get the wonderful stage when the carrot starts coming to you. You're just sitting there and just all these things are happening. All the things you say in those little books and manuals, it's just happening. You don't do it. You just sit there and it comes to you. Very good, yeah. Okay, we'll see. Okay, come on, over there. It would be very nice if people in the same part of the hall could actually ask the questions and then move gently down. Poor Renee doesn't get exhausted.
Hi, thank you. I'm just new to my personal development with Buddhism, and I'm just seeking direction on a good place to start my personal development. Like I heard people talking about chanting, different, any open to the floor, any directions appreciated.
So, which Mark, these mics haven't been doing anything yet.
Well, I can't see the gentleman on the furthest there, so maybe the gentleman next. Oh, yeah, please.
Okay. So you poke your head over the parapet, so you've got to answer the question now. You got the?
No.
Okay.
Okay. So if I can understand the question again, it was that you're new to Buddhism and you want some thoughts on how to get onto it, I guess. Okay. I think quite central to the path, Ajahn says that joy and happiness makes you stick to it, gives you the energy and the attraction to hold you on to it and progress along it. So, as opposed to if you suffered and you gave yourself pain and trouble and slopped over the path, then you probably give up sooner or later. So find things that inspires you. If meditation inspires you, if chanting inspires you, if reading inspires you, if hanging out with good friends and serving the community inspires you, that's see whatever pulls you in first. Yeah, so that's a good place to start. And then if I suppose that there are some established paths to learn about the Four Noble Truths, to know what it says, and then and hear a bit about Ajahn Brahm's explanations about all these things, because it does give an interesting twist, an interesting perspective that I suppose us English-speaking people could relate to more easily, without going too far into the metaphysical, theoretical stuff. Yeah, Ajahn Brahm's teaching tends to be a bit more down-to-earth, a lot more digestible, palatable. I'm polishing the apple. but I should add, and I suppose this answers some of the other questions, aspects of the other questions as well. As you know, you might have heard old monks don't lie, and Ajahn Brahm is an old monk. And one of his famous quotes is that meditation is better than sex, right? And I guess for us in lay, not for us, in for people in lay life, you would think, okay, that's probably as far as you can get to pleasure-wise. And this old monk says, there's something else beyond. Not easy to understand, but he promises it, or at least he seems to have seen it for himself. So that's the carrot to dangle in front.
There's a couple of questions for me here, but then the other ones are not specified. So, well, first of all, we've got from someone in Taiwan. Okay, this is, could you please give an explanation of the citta, the mind, and what happens to it when it reaches nirvana? If there is no self, how could it be said that anything is reborn and eventually attains liberation? Exactly. So, this citta, this is the mind, the sixth sense. So, you can explain what it is, but that doesn't really mean very much to people. We can say all these wonderful things like the put your left, okay, let's do this little down to earth little exercise. Put your hand up right now. If the right hand, if you are happy, put your left hand up if you are unhappy. Okay, and you have to choose either the right hand or the left hand. Right hand if you're happy, left hand if you're unhappy. Right up. Okay, now keep it up there. Now with your index finger, please point to that happiness. Point to it. Where is it? Where is it? Up there. Some people are pointing in here, some going all over the place. Well, were you just imagining your happiness? Was it real? If it's real, why can't you point to it? Why can't you locate it? And is it your partner? Have you got a leg? Point to it. I can do that down here. So why can't this something called happiness, but you couldn't locate it? Because happiness, like fear, like love, like anger, it doesn't exist in the body. It can be manifested in the body, but it exists beyond the physical world in the realm of the mind. So, just like what you call a garden, this hall isn't a garden. You know it's a garden. You've got grass, trees, bushes, flowers. That is called a garden. You know it by its contents. Makes it known as a garden. The same as the mind. The mind is known by its contents. Things like just happiness, peace, joy, bliss, love, fear. Those are the things which define this thing which we call the mind, the citta. So what happens is to really get to know that, you've got the five physical senses and you've got the outside sense, you've got the mind. It is like an emperor. And this emperor, whenever the emperor appears in public, the emperor is covered from head to foot with five garments. The emperor has boots which cover the feet, the legs, way up to the thighs. Has trousers which overlap the top of the boots and go way up, halfway up his chest. Sorry, the chest. He's got a jacket which overlaps the top of the trousers, long sleeves and a high neck. And he's got gloves which overlap the end of the sleeves. And lastly, a helmet which totally overlaps the top of the jacket. In fact, those five pieces of clothing totally cover the emperor. So much so that no one knows who the emperor is. Whether it's from New Zealand, whether it's from United States, whether it's from Sri Lanka or Thailand, a man, a woman, transgender, don't know what it is, never seen it, old or young. Because always covered with the five pieces of clothing. The emperor is powerful, but no one can really understand what this emperor is. In that similar, the emperor is called citta, the mind. The only time most people see it is when it's covered with five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch. So we have all sorts of theories about what the emperor is, or even whether it exists or not. But no one sees it unless you learn how to take off the five pieces of clothing. How you can allow the sense of sight, sound, smell, taste and touch to totally disappear, to vanish. And then you can see what this emperor is. And that's what you do with meditation. That's the whole point of jhanas. For the five senses to fade away. And what you're left with is just the citta. Nothing else but the citta. And then you have a chance to understand what its nature is. But are you prepared?
do you really want to know? Because what you find out might not be what you expect. And if you do find out, it's not only, I was going to say mind-boggling, but that doesn't really make much sense. The mind is mind-boggling. It boggles itself. It changes a lot. Number one, it's so wonderful free. That's why I say, bliss better than sex. Come on, Ajahn Brahm, you must have lost your mind. No, you've seen your mind. And after a while, you realize that even the mind, it just sedated and disappeared, to fade away. There's nothing there. It's empty. So all this thing about explanation of the jitta and what happens when it reaches nirvana, once you understand what this jitta actually is, of course, like anything else, it arises and passes away, and after a while it passes away and never arises again. That is called parinibbana. That's two types of nirvana. Nirvana, when a person becomes enlightened, they're still alive and conscious, but when they die, then that's gone forever. Freedom at last. So that's the parinibbana, with nothing remaining. That's why they call it parinibbana, complete, total. And the simile which the Buddha used again and again, a few times, was the simile of the oil lamp. Now, I changed that a little bit because we don't really have oil lamps except in Sri Lanka. Candles we have. So a candle has a flame, and that flame depends upon three causes. The wax, that's the fuel, the wick, and the heat. And that keeps the flame going. When any one of those three causes is used up, so there's no more wax, or the wick is all burnt through, or someone blows the heat away, then there's no more flame. And the Buddha asks, where does that flame go to? Does it go to the east, the west, the north, or the south, up or down? Or is, I just make that a little bit more interesting. Does it go to the heaven realm, where all flames can live happy ever after, if they've done good things? We know some flames, they can actually burn down houses, like in bushfires. So do such flames, they go down to the hell realms, where bad flames go and live? That's nonsense speak, isn't it? When the flame goes out, it just goes out, it doesn't go anywhere. Just three causes. When those causes finish, so does the flame. You know, in Pali, what the word for a flame going out, an ordinary flame in a person's little house or in the little hut in the village, when the flame goes out, in nibbanas. Nibbana was a word which was used by even little kids to describe the flame going out. Mummy, the oil lamp was nibbana'd. Even the kids would understand what that word meant. But now it gets very complicated. So that's what it meant. So the kids are just nibbana's. Go. I told you, if you really understand this stuff, sometimes, do I really want to become a Buddhist? Do I really want to become enlightened? That's one of the problems, because we're not ready yet to let go. Anyway, next one. I know you don't pray. Is daily reflection and thankfulness enough? Enough for what? Okay, to pray. Sometimes that people, what they pray for, they asked me to do this, to have some chanting so that their restaurant can get more people. I did this once for a Thai restaurant up north. They didn't have enough customers, so they asked me to go there and do a blessing, so I did a blessing for them. You know what happened? They got too many customers, and the staff was
worked off their feet. So because of that, they never invited me again. It was too successful. So be careful what you pray for. Do you really want that? So be careful. Do you want to win the lottery? Be careful what you want. Anyway, daily reflection and thankfulness enough. The best thing to do is to do some meditation. Thankfulness is great. Reflection is wonderful. And gratitude. So the best thing to do is just the virtue, meditation and wisdom. Okay. I'll just do one more and then I'll pass on the difficult ones to other people. What is the oldest monk that you know was ordained? And is it appropriate for an older person to ordain? Is there an age limit? Okay, the oldest person in the suttas was 120 years of age. And that's a lot. And 120 years that he was ordained, he got enlightened a couple of months later, and then he passed away fully enlightened. So, leaving it to the last minute, but that was a special case. If you're 120, forget it. However, it's everybody according to their abilities. So, you know, there's some people, you know, the current Sangharaja of Thailand, I met him just last year, he's 92. But he's just so fit and clear and just, and he got Mahathir. In, you know, 92 years of age, and he's a Prime Minister of Malaysia again. I really was upset when I heard that. Because I always thought that, you know, when you get to 70 or something, you can retire. And now people say, well, if the Prime Minister can't retire at 92, you've got no hope, Ajahn Brahm. So the oldest monk I know who was ordained is appropriate an old person to learn. It really depends upon many, many things. Just, you know, their abilities, their health, and also just, you know, also what we take into account, you have to, this gratitude. If a person's really helped out a lot, and they've really done so much wonderful service, you know, to your temple, you know, it's just, they've helped me so much, they've helped the monastery, the nuns so much, we must help them back. The only problem is, of course, when they get very old, it takes a lot of effort and work to look after them, to make sure that they are physically well looked after, because they can't contribute very much. But a lot of them have contributed a lot before, so okay, now we can look after them. Okay. Anyway, the best thing to do is to do it quickly, before you get too old. Anyway, do you want to do a few? I left you the easy ones.
So there's a question number one. I took the precepts previously, but I broke the first to control an infestation which killed one pet and was harming another. We unfortunately now have the same situation, and how shall I address this? Just to share with you, I have to make a decision to deal with our termite problem. We have very bad termite problem, even our mattress, our old cottage, that we have to rip off our floor, and I have to ask the termite guy to come and have a look, and I have to make the decision. And then, of course, if you are the one on top, so you put your head on the chopping board, so I have to give the order, you know, because it's really bad, you know, we have termite problem. So it's not that I wanted to do it. And besides, the Buddha said the first noble truth is inherently unsatisfactory. Sometimes we always put in the situation that no-win situation. Sometimes we have to force to make decision like that. And so it's just the whole cycle that is very difficult to avoid, that we don't live on the expense of others. So the only way out is not to be reborn. That is the best way. So when you're still in the samsara, you can't get away. It's just like, I have to make that decision. I have to do that, you know. So I have to, you know, because you are the one on top. So you have to give order and you have to do that. But it's not that my intention wasn't there. I have no intention to kill, you know. But there is a problem, and then, you know, you need to fix. If not, the whole house will collapse, you know. And but because we have the building there, we benefit more. Then I look at it. Then we have more bhikkhunis, we have more enlightened beings in the world, you know. So there's a sometimes that is part of being in this cycle of rebirth. So that sometimes you have to make this difficult decision, and I have to make that. I have to do that.
So you're not perfect.
Yes, I'm not perfect. Yeah.
Anyone perfect?
Anyone here perfect?
Buddha. Okay. But even Ajahn Chah, I was there at the time when he had the termites were coming into the huts, and even he sort of authorized, during that time was DDT around the huts. I say that because Ajahn Chah was one person I would say was totally enlightened. The point is that we try our very, very best. And sometimes it's because we don't know build things appropriately. We try and do our very best to make sure the termites and other animals are not, you know, in the buildings. To keep things really, really clear. No, that's just passing the buck. So because in a monastery they ask, you know, you're the abbot, you're the responsible, sangha decision. So sometimes we have to. Well, that again. Layperson's duty to kill everything. No. Yes, and yes. Oh, yeah, they.
I didn't do that.
Yeah,
but
you have to
give permission. You have to ask those guys to come to do it.
Yes.
We don't do it. We didn't do it. I didn't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, sometimes it's very difficult. You know, sometimes I try so hard to avoid to go down to that track. But sometimes, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes we can only do our best. You know, at the end of the day, I know that I have, you know, I did my very best, and okay, I have no like remorse or whatever. I know that I have done my very best. That's the best I can do. So that's why life is like that. You can only do your best.
We always try very best, make sure, find out why they were coming in there and try to make it a little bit better next time so that you don't have things which they can eat, that you have termite protection. As best you possibly can, but there's always ways people get in.
Now we put in the barrier.
Yeah.
Okay. So hopefully we solve the problem.
Yeah.
But we don't know.
I just give the loving kindness.
Yeah.
And may all those termites be reborn in a wonderful place where they can to the termite, where will be termite heaven? The local woodyard.
It's just the human reason.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
If you don't come in termite again,
yeah.
You get something else.
Okay. There's another question down there.
Another question is that, yes, if I calm down my body and mind, how can I be sure I do not push my problems deeper in our subconsciousness and become worse? I feel calm outside, inside confused.
There you go. Easy one.
Actually, of course you know, actually, if you're happier and things don't bother you, then you know that you know, because if you try to push, actually you get more agitated and irritated. You know? You cannot be so peaceful and calm and nice. You can't. Just like Ajahn Brahm just now mentioned already, you know, you can't just push and become peaceful and calm. Isn't it? So it's just, the question is a bit contradictory. Actually, you know, if you're really peaceful and calm, so you're not pushing. If you're pushing, if you try very hard, And then I heard some people told me, how come I meditate after 2 hours? Why I'm so tired? So I said, you are trying too hard. You know? You try to focus, you try to, you know, too hard. You know, so much energy to try to push, you know. That's why you know if you're peaceful and calm and relaxed and let go, and you have beautiful breath, then you know that you're really letting go. You know, for sure you know for yourself, if you still have the kind of agitation and irritation, that means you're pushing too hard. Okay? I hope this answers the question. Any more?
Finished? Yes. Thank you for doing the difficult ones. The thing about the nature of the mind is easy. So, any questions again from the floor? Yes, we have from Mr. Sampop.
This is my first question for the first 30 years.
Wow.
My question is not a Dhamma, it's not too deep, because my head is too stupid for the question like that. So I would like to ask Ajahn Brahm, when you were a young monk, and have you ever get sick of what you're doing? Probably you think, what I'm doing here? Another thing is, are you happy right now that you bring more Westerner people to come to become a Buddhist?
Okay. When I look back, was I really sometimes I wasn't happy what I was doing? I'd probably say no, because that's one of the things when you get to be an old monk, you get into denial of the past. So no, you just let it go. Unhappy. What I was doing. Oh, you were working hard, but it was a great adventure. It was amazing, just being a young monk in Thailand with Ajahn Chah, it was incredibly sort of tough. Yeah, there's one time, and most of those stories you remember, when you're pushing the wheelbarrows, and just, you know, for that story's in the first book I wrote, and it's a great story. I had to push wheelbarrows a foot of dirt for about 9 hours, 10 hours a day, and just, you know, just one meal of a day. And we have actually got the volume there, Ajahn Chah's biography, got pictures. You can actually see me there, just all skin and bones, believe it or not. That's why, you know, you just go from one extreme when you're young, go to the other extreme now. Just, you know, it's just the way. But it was really thin. I worked 9 days of hard work, and these senior monks couldn't decide where they're going to put that earth. And of course, I was really upset. I didn't become a monk to be a labourer. In Australia, you wouldn't be able to get away with that. The unions would be on workplace health and safety, you know, penalty rates, you know, proper food, and just, you know, clothing, which was, oh, that was disgusting what I was doing there. And I was really upset. After 6 days, I'd had enough. And then what happened was, I was just swearing. In English, you know, because that's, I'm thinking the Thais can understand. But they can. Body language, they know what you're going on. Just probably, these monks. But the senior monks, they just sat in their room just having cups of tea, talking to all the visitors. They didn't have to push this wheelbarrow full of earth. Really unfair. Exploitation, that's what it was. Slave labour. So anyway, I was getting very upset. And that's when this monk came to me. I could understand enough Thai by then. And he said, pushing the wheelbarrow is the easy part. Thinking about it is the hard part. And, you know, sometimes, yeah, I didn't want to be there at the time, but I'm glad I was there, because you learned so much. And that just a simple teaching like that, you know, was worth, you know, so much of studies of suttas and Abhidharma and stuff, because that was so direct, personal experience. Though I was suffering, I didn't want to be there. And as soon as I realized the thinking, that was the complaining, that was what was causing the suffering. So I stopped thinking about it. Just did it. And then it became fun again. It was actually fun. We'd have races, you know, with other monks who would get there first. And if they beat me and they got there first, then you know, women have to fill the wheelbarrow up again. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm tired, I miss it, went all over you, terribly sorry. You're like little kids playing. And that was became fun. And then stop thinking about it, complaining, and then there was no problem. So that wasn't the places I didn't want to be, but you learned from those places you didn't want to be just how to solve those problems. So it's wonderful. And the last one was, am I happy to be here now?
Are you happy that you bring all...
Happy that
are you happy right now that you bring more Westerner people that who not the Buddhist born?
Oh yeah, no. That's terrible.
Buddhist.
You know, for a long time I've been telling these stories again and again and again, and just telling terrible jokes with the intent of getting rid of you all, so I can have a nice peaceful life. So, I'm really joking. No, you just do whatever, and just if people like it, fine. If they don't like it, that's fine. So, this place has grown a lot. And so, but you don't teach to make it grow. You just teach because you just teach. So just as you were saying earlier, you do things not expecting anything back in return. You just give. If people come, that's great. If they don't come, that's great. So that means that if you get lots of people coming, it's wonderful. You're spreading the Dhamma and inspiring lots of people. If people don't like your talks, that's even better. Then they can become a hermit. Oh, this wonderful cave. I miss my cave. I like my cave. But I don't ever get to use it. Even when I'm there, it's like I'm the only monk, I think, in the whole world whose bedroom is a tourist attraction. Because people want to go and have a look at my cave. Crazy. But yeah, I'm happy enough. Very good. Thank you, Sompot. You know, Sompot, he was with his father. He was the first Anagarika at Bodhinyana Monastery. When we moved in, he came there with his dad, little Sompop, myself, Ajahn Chakro, and myself. The first four residents of Bodhinyana Monastery, 35 years ago. 35 years ago, yeah. And he was very small at that time, just like me. But looking after the place all that time. Good old Sompop. Very good. And so people say, oh, he's got a stupid mind. He's not. He's smart. The ones who think they're smart, they're the stupid ones. The ones who think they're stupid, they're the smart ones. Be careful. So are you smart or stupid? You say, I'm smart. Okay, we've got maybe one or two more questions, then we have to finish off. Yeah, at the back.
Ajahn.
Oh, yeah.
You have been become the abbot for a very long time now for the Buddhist Western.
Oh, yeah, about time to retire.
And I would like to know whether is there any change of the abbot that you're going to retire and the other monk will take over your place in the future?
Yeah, that's awesome. That's my plan. But they won't let me. No, it's as long as that you are healthy and the monks, you're doing okay, that's fine. But it was a few years ago that I went to a conference. It was in Vietnam, in Hanoi, and they sitting next to Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh. And, you know, he gave up and gave a talk. He's a very inspiring monk. But then when he gave a talk at this conference, you can see that, you know, he was too old. And just, you know, this presentation, the ideas, they didn't flow as well as when he was young. And it reminded me like one of those boxers who just, you know, is too old, should have retired, but still keeps coming back. And so there will come a time, and, you know, that will happen with every one of us, when, you know, the talks, we keep repeating ourselves a bit too much. And, you know, you don't have that fire, that inspiration, that energy And that's a time just to let the monk or the nun just, okay, you've done a wonderful service, now just take it a bit more easy. Otherwise we keep getting these old monks to come up and they just don't have, they can't, you know, have that same sort of ability to present Dharma which you had when you were young. The ideas, the innovation, the ability just to answer questions in a deep way. So there comes a time, if ever that happens with me, I told the other monks and the nuns as well, okay Ajahn Brahm, now's your time to, you've done enough, now's the time for you to retire. And just you bring me out every just, you know, maybe Waisak, once a year, you know, just to have a look, and then you put me back again. that's true, because sometimes some of the monks, they and the nuns, they can be very inspiring, but don't expect them to you know, have that energy. It's part of your body, your brain, that sometimes we become... I saw this with so many people. Ajahn Chah, he went to see another great monk, Ajahn Kao, and he said, how are they treating you? And he told Ajahn Kao, he said, oh, they treat me like a monkey in a cage. They come to see me at Wat Pa Phong, they poke me, and just to see me, not to listen to any Dhamma, just to say, oh, you know, I've seen Ajahn Chah. It's like you see sort of a famous monk or a famous person, you know, oh, I've had a picture, you know, with Donald Trump, I've had a picture with Angelina Jolie, I've had a picture, you know, with Ajahn Brahm. That's not the purpose of a monk's life or a nun's life. So there comes a time when, okay, enough. Because it's important we take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. In the Sangha, not a particular monk or nun. So after a while, we pass the baton on to somebody else to be the teacher. And people have been telling me there's some very good monks and nuns coming up. And that's one of my most important goals, to make sure that not end up like what Ajahn Chah once told me. He said, towards the end of his life, he said, I have built many temples, many monasteries, but I haven't built many monks. Wonderful. It's easy to build temples. It's hard work, but it's, you know, much easier to build out really good monks and now good nuns. And, you know, just, you are so fortunate here having really good bhikkhunis. And I say that because that's so rare in our world. So well done. Okay, there's one last question in the back over there, so I saw his hand up.
This is for each of the panelists, but if they could be briefly just describe what it means by the middle way, especially as it pertains to living in a modern society.
Okay, so we'll start from the end first of all. Venerable, do you want to pass it down? Venerable, go to me. What does it mean, living the middle way? Oh, that's not an excuse. You mean it's dead?
Dead.
Ah, you did that by your psychic power, so you don't have to answer the question. Okay. What it means by the middle way, my quick one, is that, again, you avoid the extremes, especially in meditation, practices which tire you, using too much force so you feel exhausted. Instead, just letting go, being kind, being gentle, which means that your practice goes very deep, very powerful. And you do let go. Letting go is a middle way. We consume too much in our modern world. So it's wonderful if we can do less. Do more with less. Well, actually, no, do less with even less. So we're too busy. It's all about making peace, being kind, and being gentle. That's my middle way in our modern world. Next. We're supposed to be brief. All right, every panelist.
Yes, the middle way is that you not to try too hard, And but not too, you know, lazy and too lax, you know. And you know for yourself, you know. Actually, the middle way is not happen immediately. Sometimes you try, you know, sometimes you know that, you know, this way it doesn't work, and then you try another way, and then you feel that, oh, it doesn't work. Then, you know, then this is how you just like, you know, like your kick car, you need to tune it, you know. Then you slowly, you cannot just attain that middle way, you know. It takes time. Sometimes we swing from one end to another, so we improve, we swing less and less and less and less, then we middle way. So this is how you achieve that middle way. It's not going to happen overnight. So you should make mistakes. Sometimes we swing too much this side, and sometimes we say, oh, maybe too much this side. I swing more that side, and then too much. Then we try to put it more back again, but you still don't get it right. You know, it takes time. So then your swing will be like that, 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 that. Neither.
Okay, very good. Okay, because we've actually run out of time now. It's 4:30 and people are lining up overseas. But I cannot help but tell one of the summing up for the middle way. It's an old saying I heard a long time ago. The one who walks the middle way gets hit by traffic coming in both directions. Yeah, we always get hit. So, okay. So,
what happened, Ajahn, is someone overtake.
Okay. So now, thank you for that Q&A session. Now we're doing a little ceremony for the new Buddhists. So every year, this is Waisak celebration, and we acknowledge many people are online. Some people have got up really early in the morning in other countries so they can join in this little ceremony where we give them the three refuges and the five precepts. And there's also people here who have taken come to take the three refuges and the five precepts first of all. So those who are present in our center here, could you please come up to the front so we can give you the three refuges and the five precepts for the very first time. And of course, we're always becoming a Buddhist society which has few possessions and allows people to renounce. We have many gifts for you as well. So, wow, look at all these gifts. Buddhist gifts.
Yes, we have.
Do you want this bag? Yeah. Okay. Hey, I can do that one back here. Okay. No, it's okay. You're fine. Oops. Okay. So those of you who are tuning in online from overseas, in a couple of minutes we'll give the three refuges and the five precepts, and hopefully you have a copy of the five precepts. If not, I will chant them in. How many people here? So there's a lot of people here who are Asian, so shall I do it in Mandarin? No. In Hokkien? In Sinhala? Okay, we'll do it in English. Okay. So, for those of you... Oh, good, you have the English one here. So, are we ready? So, on the little book here, we do have the... I don't have the English translation here.
Oh, we have over here. On what I have here on page 2, homage to the Blessed One, and then to the Buddha I go for refuge. Okay, so hopefully everybody is online now. These are the people who are going to be living as best they possibly can by the 5 precepts. Okay, so we can do this all together, I think, in this particular occasion. So it's homage to the Blessed One, Noble and Perfect Enlightened One. So are you ready? 1, 2, 3. Homage to the Blessed, Noble and Perfectly Enlightened One. Have you got it on the page? You haven't found it? Okay, I've got it on page 2. Page 2? Page 2, homage. It's got page 2 on the bottom. Just right there. You got that one? Found it? Okay. So, 1, 2, 3 again. Homage to the Blessed, Noble and Perfectly Enlightened One. Homage to the Blessed, Noble and Perfectly Enlightened One. Homage to the Blessed, Noble and Perfectly Enlightened One. That's the usual Namo Tassa. Now we go to the 3 refuges. To the Buddha I go for refuge. To the Dhamma I go for refuge. To the Sangha I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Buddha I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Dhamma I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Sangha I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Buddha I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Dhamma I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Sangha I go for refuge. And that completes the going to the 3 refuges. In the Pali, that's Buddhang Savanangacchami, Dhammang Savanangacchami, Sanghang Savanangacchami. And if you go to traditional Buddhist temples throughout the world, you will hear that little chant, Buddhang Savanangacchami, in all traditions. So I think it might be nice. Can we do it also in the Pali as well? Yeah, okay. If you can't actually pronounce it, just lip sync, as they say. Where's that one? That's over in page somewhere. Oh, 20, yeah. Okay, here we go. Well, actually, we can all join in this one, because, yeah, let's do Buddhang, yeah, Savanangacchami.
Buddhang Savanangacchami, Dhammang Savanangacchami, Sanghang Savanangacchami, Dutiyampi Buddhang Savanangacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammang Savanangacchami, Dutiyampi Sanghang Savanangacchami, Tatiyampi Buddhang Savanangacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammang Savanangacchami, Tatiyampi Sanghang Savanangacchami.
And now we go to the 5 precepts. And those precepts I will do in English because at least you know what they mean.
which is on the, sorry, I don't have a page number for it, but the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I undertake the precepts. And you say it's to refrain from. So it means that you try your very best, you know, not to kill any living beings and take what is not given. So you need to know the danger, and it's really exceptional circumstances that you break any of these. I mean exceptional. I undertake the precept. Please say after me. I undertake the precept. You say? To refrain from destroying living creatures. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking what is not given. I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. I undertake the precept to refrain from lying. I undertake the precept to refrain from intoxicating liquors and non-medicinal drugs which lead to carelessness. And I'll do the chant here. These are the five precepts. Through virtue they lead to a happy rebirth. Through virtue they lead to prosperity. Through virtue they lead to liberation. Therefore one should purify virtue. Now those five precepts, to understand what you're doing, to refrain from deliberately destroying living creatures, as Venerable Hasapanya sort of accurately said, we try our very, 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 very best to try and avoid destruction. And sometimes we go to extreme levels to try and avoid that. An example was, there was a monastery over in Sussex, and they had a problem, an infestation of rabbits. And it was farmland was around. And they said the farmers were trying to shoot and capture the rabbits, but the rabbits were going into the Buddhist monastery for sanctuary. And so they said, well, you know, we understand you don't like to kill sort of the rabbits, but they are causing a problem for our livelihood. They're destroying all of our crops. So it was a difficult situation. So what this monastery did, it cost them a lot of money. They put a rabbit fence, not to keep the rabbits out of the monastery, but to keep them in. So the rabbits could be happily living in the monastery, and they couldn't escape to go and bother the surrounding farmland. And people said, you monks are crazy, because those rabbits will just multiply and multiply and multiply until they just get out of control. But that was many years, and the rabbit fence around the monastery is still there, so the rabbits can't escape, but they, somehow or other, they have their own ways of limiting their population, and so the population is stable all the time there. And if you go to that monastery over in Chithurst, you see the rabbits, they come out, they're not afraid of the monks or the visitors, they're really quite cute. And then they found their own little way of being in harmony. But it's also, it means protects all the farmland. So the farmland out around is not bothered by the rabbits. A very nice little way. To refrain from taking what is not given, and that's called like stealing. And that also includes, if you are a Buddhist, your tax returns. You've got to be honest. So we pay what we need to pay. From sexual misconduct, that means like the non-consensual sex. It doesn't mean, you know, just heterosexual sex. I mean, whatever sex there is, the contact we have with one another, the intimacy, to make sure that it is consensual, that you're not sort of exploiting, you know, children or those who are in a senior position of power and they're in a lesser position of power, as like a teacher to a student, or so it is being kind for one another and being sensitive to one another, not people who are in a position where they don't really know what they're doing, such as they're drunk or on drugs. So this is the sexual misconduct, which is so important in our modern world. You know, it's been coming up a lot in recent times. So we make sure that, you know, in the five precepts, you know, that you will have partners, you will have relationships, but make sure it doesn't abuse one another. And restraining from lying, so we do as best we possibly can to always try and, you know, tell the truth. There was a story of a gentleman in Amsterdam in the time of the Second World War, and this gentleman was hiding Jewish family up in his house. And when the secret police in that time, the Gestapo, was searching house to house, and when they knocked at his door and they asked him, he said, "Have you any Jewish people in your house?" He was put in a difficult situation. You know, if he said yes, was honest, then those family would be taken away and would be killed. But then if he said no, he'd be lying. And this was the story, and I thought this was really quite inspiring. He said, "Come and have a look for yourself." And he said it with such a sense of honesty that the police said, "Okay, thank you very much," and they left him. Because, you know, he'd always been so trustworthy. There was something about him, some virtue, which actually protected not only himself, but the people he was protecting as well. It may not work for everybody, but for him, his virtue was so strong, it protected him and the people he was shielding as well. Amazing. But anyway, we try our very best also not to put ourselves in a position where we have to lie. And also to undertake the precept to refrain from alcohol, which intoxicates you, even the small amounts, you all know. And those of you who like wine, you can always get non-alcoholic wine, because, you know, these things are just developed because people know they are dangerous if you are driving. And sometimes even in business now, it is much better accepted that you can be in business and you can go to functions, receptions. You don't have to have alcohol. And I always tell the story, when I gave up alcohol as a student, while I was still partying, I really thought that giving up alcohol would be a big sacrifice. I would not be invited to any more parties. And I didn't give up everything. I like girlfriends and music and messing around. But you know, I was invited to even more parties. I couldn't believe it. You know, even though I didn't drink any alcohol, because I always wanted somebody sober to drive them home. That was me. So you got more invitations. It's great. So anyway, and also the non-medicinal drugs. So it doesn't mean that, you know, your doctor says you have to have some insulin, or you have to have antipsychotics, or even, I'm not sure, it probably will happen, like medicinal cannabis. Okay, if that's prescribed by a doctor, but not for recreational use, because that can sometimes really mess up your mind. So that's where we restrain from these, and that actually makes you feel much more responsible, alert, mindful, which means you don't get into trouble. Now, one of the worst things which one of the funeral services which I did, which made me most sad probably, there was a student, I think she was of Curtin University, could have been Murdoch, Chinese student, in the time when you could only have just one child, single child policy. She worked really hard, her parents were poor, she worked really, really hard, through scholarships, got to study here in Perth. She just graduated, and parents had managed to scrape the money together to fly to Perth to come to her only daughter's graduation. They sacrificed so much for that. And she was just walking down the street with her parents, Kelmscott or Gosnells, on the Albany Highway, and a car with two drunk drivers
just lost control, came over into the sidewalk and just killed the girl in front of the parents' eyes. And, you know, because they were nominal Buddhists, I was asked to do the funeral service for them. And these two parents, they couldn't understand a word of English, but you could see, I can understand, you know, what they were saying. We could have a little taste of what they were feeling. They were totally just confused. The meaning of their life, which they'd invested in their only child, which was in front of their very eyes, was just snatched away from them. And that was just so painful to see that. And because somebody just had one too many drinks and thought they were in control. And it's not just your life, it affects other people, as I saw there. So please, if you can, just giving up alcohol is a wonderful thing. It's not necessary. You can still have a wonderful, happy time without it. So those are the five precepts. So that's why it's not a burden to take them. You feel so free and happy and energized afterwards. Now, we have the gifts. So first of all, we have some people from overseas. Have the people.